We know that the ark was a very special piece of furniture. And whenever we read about the construction of it, we read about things that God considered holy. You know, all of the furniture that was in the tabernacle and the instructions that were given to Moses at Mount Sinai and the instructions that were given also in Numbers and Leviticus underscore that fact. And so the focus of my lesson tonight is for us to learn a lesson about revering or reverencing or honoring that which is holy. The word holy is a frequently used word in the Bible. In the New American Standard Version, there are 670 occurrences of the word holy or holiness. And so that tells us that this is something that God wants us to pay careful attention to. We know that the word holy means to be set apart or consecrated, are terms that are cognates of the word holy. And again, it's the idea of respecting or reverencing that which is very special to God. And of course, we know that everything connected with God is holy because He's holy. And He told the Israelites that at the giving of the law, "Be ye holy, for I am holy," Leviticus 19 and in verse 2. But on the other hand, we know that there's a lot of unholiness in the world, and there was a lot of unholiness in previous generations too. So how are we going to counteract the propensity for some to be unholy and at the same time learn these valuable lessons from the Bible? Well, hopefully this incident with Uzzah is going to help us in that regard tonight. We know that Uzzah, according to 2 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 3, was a son of Abinadab. Now, Abinadab, which I don't know much more about him other than the fact that he was Uzzah's son and that he lived in Kiriath-Jearim, it's kind of an interesting situation when you reflect upon his role in the history of the ark. Just to refresh our memories for a moment, the Philistines had captured the ark, okay? And they took it down to Philistia, and they passed it around among the cities of Ekron and Ashdod and Gath and the major cities in Philistia. You know, there were five of them. I don't remember all five of them off the top of my head. They had a bit of a problem with it because everywhere they took it, the Lord sent a message to them that, you know what, you are treading on thin ice because you are not revering God. And so he inflicted them with some diseases and some problems. We'll talk a little more about that in just a moment. So they decided that they needed to get this out of their hair because this ark was causing them all kinds of problems. So they loaded it up on this cart and put these milk cows in front of it, and they sent it off down the road, and it wound up coming to Beth Shemesh, and the people of Beth Shemesh took it, and then they took it to Abinadab in Kiriath-Jearim, and the record tells us that, go back to 1 Samuel here, 1 Samuel chapter 7. The men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. So now here's another son of Abinadab called Eleazar. And what we've got is the ark in his house. Now that's a pretty stunning thought if you really, you know, consider it for a moment. I mean, the ark was in the eyes of a lot of people, the most prized representation of God's presence that you could have. It was supposed to be in the Holy of Holies, but of course it had been captured by the Philistines, and now here it winds up in Uzzah's house. I don't know how old Uzzah was. That's kind of Uzzah. Get my Zuzzes straight there. I don't know how old Uzzah was, but at some time or another, he's bound to have seen this ark, or, I mean, at least he knew it was there. Okay. The best guesstimate is that the ark stayed in Abinadab's house for 70 years. Now, you have to look at all the different texts and put the numbers together and add them up, and you come out with around 70. So that was a long time for the ark to be in his house. And what I find absolutely mind-boggling is that, assuming that Uzzah grew up in the house where the ark was, and I think that's a very safe assumption, how he would not know something about it. I mean, he would probably know a lot of things about it. I mean, can you imagine as you get older and you see, this is the ark over there, and I don't know if it had a covering on it or not, but anyway, it was very special. Eliezer had been appointed to take care of it. This natural inquisitiveness would cause a child, and as you grew older, to say, hey, Dad, what about the ark? What about that? That's just an old box I pick up at a flea market somewhere. I don't think so. He would undoubtedly tell him what it was and the significance of it, and I rather expect that he would recount to him how he got it. Because, after all, how are you going to explain the Ark of the Covenant in your house? It didn't just fall out of the sky. So how did it get there? Well, again, this is a history, I believe, that we need to factor into our understanding of Uzzah's actions. I mentioned ago that the Ark had been taken by the Philistines down to Ashdod, and where they started out with it. They brought it down to Ashdod. This is in chapter 5 of 1 Samuel. And they put it in the house of Dagon. And Dagon was their god. Well, of course, what they're going to think is that, hey, looky here, our god is better than your god. Well, they found out otherwise, because next morning when they got up, Dagon had fallen on his face. Well, we know that that was a miracle. But the point is, to the Philistines, hey, Dagon is not so hot after all. Because the Ark of the Covenant, in his presence, he fell on his face. So, that caused him a little bit of consternation. And besides all that, according to verse 6, the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. He ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both in Ashdod and the territories. So, they've got this problem with the ark in their presence. They're having, they decide, well, maybe we better send it down to Ekron, verse 10, and they did. And the people said, hey, what are you trying to do, kill us? Wait a minute, we know this thing is big trouble. So, that's finally how they decided that they needed to get this ark out of their hair because of all of the problems that they had, and they put it on the cart with the milk cows, and it wound up in Beth Shemesh, and then the Kiriath Jearim folks went down and got it from Beth Shemesh. But what I'm saying is that even though the text doesn't tell us, certainly Abinadab told Uzzah about the history of this ark that was in their house. I just can't imagine that he wouldn't have. And he probably told him about the instructions that Samuel had given to the people. Look in 1 Samuel chapter 7, because this is a significant part of Israelite history. Verses 3 and 4. Again, this is after the ark is brought into the house of Abinadab. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord and his Lord alone. So in connection with the presence of the ark, the instructions of Samuel had been to the whole nation of Israel, you obey God. And they did. So there is an element of respect or reverence for the ark in the house of Uzzah and in the nation of the Israelites at this time. Skipping on down to verse 9, this is 1 Samuel 7, verse 9. And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord, and Samuel cried to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel.
But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on the day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel.
So again, this is more history. The Lord with his people who respect and revere him and obey him. And miraculously, at that point in time, he thwarted the advancing armies of the Philistines. So, verse 11 says, "And then the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them down as far as Bethkar. Then Samuel took the stone, set it between Mizpah and Shin, and named it Ebenezer, saying, 'Thus far the Lord has helped us.'"
So the connection of God helping the people of Israel when they obeyed him was an event. In connection with this particular event, you had that stone that was raised there, and it was called Ebenezer.
So Uzzah, of all men, should have known what it means to revere and respect God's will, given the history of the Israelites and the fact that the ark was in his house for 70 years. But there's another element of a mindset that is pervasive in the country that I think we need to, again, factor into this whole scenario. And that is that there was a climate of disrespect. Now remember, if that ark was in the house for, say, in Abinadab's house for 70 years, we know Saul reigned for 40 years, and we know eventually David got it out. You know, if it was 70 years total, that would have been another 30 years. So you've got that whole period of time when Saul and David are fighting against each other, and Saul's trying to kill David. And then you've also got the fact that Saul early on was, or at some point, I don't know exactly the date, but he was disrespectful of God's plan and instructions and will, because back in 1 Samuel chapter 13, we read where, you know, he was waiting there for Samuel to come. And Samuel had told him to wait until he got there, and Saul got impatient, and the people were getting impatient. They saw the Philistines coming, and so Saul decides that what he needs to do is offer some sacrifices. And so in verse 9 of 1 Samuel 13, the text says, "Saul said, 'Bring me the burnt offering and the peace offerings.' And he offered the burnt offerings and sacrifice. And it came about as soon as he finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. But Samuel said, 'What have you done?' And Saul said, 'Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash.'"
So Saul set a tone of disrespect for God, as is evidenced right here. And then you get to the 15th chapter, and you've got his disregard for the specific instructions that God gave him to completely destroy the Amalekites. And then Samuel comes and confronts him with that. And, first of all, you know, Samuel says, you know, hey, what's this lowing of sheep I hear in my ears? And, the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep so they could offer them as a sacrifice to God. That was the excuse that that Saul gave for not obeying God. Well, the verse 22, of course, is the one that really nailed Saul. Samuel said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and its insubordination is an iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king." Now, this matter of Saul being deposed and David being appointed as king was not something that was done in a closet. You know, it wasn't just a hush-hush deal. Because from henceforth until Saul died,
Saul was, you know, at various times out to kill David. And, you know, he threw a spear at him one time, and then he would chase him around, and David would get away. And so David was running all over the countryside, and he had several hundred men that were with him from time to time, hiding in caves and encountering Saul and all that. Well, again, all of that time, the ark was sitting in Uzzah's house, and people were aware of what was going on. And at some point in time, I'm persuaded that Uzzah was bound to have known about the disrespect that Saul had for God and for God's instructions. So this was also a time of arrogance in the, you know, Saul's arrogant attitude certainly had to have been something that was that people were cognizant of. Back over in 1 Samuel chapter 15, and the reason I say that is because in 1 Samuel chapter 15 verse 12, the text tells us that Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul and was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself and turned and proceeded down to Gilgal. Saul was so proud of what he was doing, he built a monument for himself. Well, again, that's something that's pretty out in the open. You know, it's right in your face. So this arrogant, I'm above the law, I can do what I want to do kind of attitude was something that the people were seeing in their leader. Now, that's not the last time that's happened, and it probably won't be the last time it happens. Even in the history of our country, how many times can you think of presidents? Just in my lifetime, I think it seems like almost every one of them, but some more than others, consider themselves to be above the law and arrogantly just bow their neck, and in fact, they violate the law. And then they like to strut around with their nose up in the air because they think they're better than everybody else. Well, it seems to me that Saul was doing some of that. And this, again, would have spilled over into or had some sort of an impact upon people at that point in time. And then, you know, you've got to bring David into the mix. I know that David was a man after God's own heart, but more than once, he stubbed his toe, you know, say the least. Now, we're not up to the point where he committed the sin with Bathsheba yet, but yet we know that there was a lot of strife and turmoil in the conflict between Saul and David. And now, as we're getting up to this point in the history, Uzzah has to be of age, perhaps even a young man, or maybe even a middle-aged man. I don't know, because, again, we're not told how old he was whenever he died. But this is going on at the same time with all of the unrest and the turmoil and the difficulty and the conflict. 2 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 1 says, Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew steadily weaker. Well, what are some of the things that was going on in that time? Well, we talked about them this morning, or we studied about this. This was part of our assignment this morning. Back in verse 31 of chapter 2 of 2 Samuel, the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's sons, so that 360 men died. Well, that's a pretty significant encounter. 360 men died in that one skirmish. And then there was the continual pursuit of David and and Saul's unrighteous attitude towards David. And then even in David's reign, there was mayhem and there was murder and there was marauding that was going on all the time. The one that again was in our lesson this morning. Well, let me just point out a couple of them besides the one that I just cited. And in the next chapter, in chapter 3, verse 30, Joab and Abishai, his brother, they killed Abner because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the Battle of Gibeon. So remember how that caused a lot of conflict between the house of David and the house of Saul. Chapter 4, verse 1.
Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, and he lost courage, and all Israel was disturbed. See, again, this is not something that was just between guys that didn't like each other. It affected the whole nation. Last phrase in verse 1 of chapter 4 says, all Israel was disturbed. And then chapter 7, these dudes that came to the house, and he was lying on his bed in his bedroom, and they struck and killed him and beheaded him, and then they took his head and traveled by way of the Arabah all night, and they brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron. And that's supposed to be represented in that graphic that I've got up there. That's not a very pleasant thought. As somebody comes strolling into your house with a guy's head in their hand and say, hey, look what I've done for you. I've chopped the, you know, killed this guy and chopped his head off. And then we know what happened. David turned around and he had them slain and cut off their hands and their feet and took them to Hebron, or in Hebron, and he took them down to the pool, the upper pool of Hebron, and put them on the wall. This is a picture of the upper pool in Hebron. It was taken in 1937. You know, I would not suggest that this is the exact same spot where those hands and feet were taken, but it was something like this. We've traveled in several places in that part of the world where there are pools, and in fact, we saw one near Pergamum that looked almost identical to this in size, and the walls, you know, they lined the walls with brick and mortar, and then there's steps going down there so the people can go down in the water, and you see... You know, these guys were standing up against this wall, and I was telling the youngsters this morning that I can just imagine those hands and feet hanging out there on that wall, and that's bound to get your attention. You know, like, ooh, you know, there's problems here. There's trouble in River City. So this was the climate. This was the climate of disrespect that was pervasive at the time of... Uzzah growing up with the ark in his house. And then if you want to add to that, David's, shall we say, women troubles? Well, again, Bathsheba hasn't entered the picture yet, but we know that he had, that David disrespected God's plan for one woman for one man for life. He had more than one wife. And there was a lot of problems in his life because of that. So, you know, it's not surprising that people who were living during this period of time would feel the impact of the unrest and the disrespect and the irreverence in their lives. So, we know that then David... is the one that instigated the recovery of the ark from Kiriath-Jearim, and he's going to bring it up to the city of David. Now, the text that Paul read in 1 Chronicles 13 starts out with an interesting statement. David consulted with the captains of the thousands, the hundreds, with every leader, and said to the assembly of Israel, if it seems good to you. And then he throws in, well, and if God agrees with it. David first seeks the will of the people before he makes the decision that he's going to take the ark or recover the ark from Kiriath-Jearim. And not only that, verse 2 says, also the priests and the Levites were gathered. You know, they were part of this gathering of people. Now, if anybody knew how God wanted that ark handled, it had to be the priests and the Levites. So when David made the decision to put the ark on a cart, and again, the text tells us in 2 Samuel that David did that. That is, obviously, David gave the instructions to do it. It was in the face of what the priests and the Levites had been taught and had been teaching others, that is to observe that they were responsible for reading the law and teaching the law to the people. So I've never quite been able to figure out how in the world David would decide to do this with all of that reservoir of information there, unless he just ignored what they said, or they ignored the law,
or he the thousands, hundreds and thousands of leaders that he consulted before he talked to the Levites said, well, you know, I think it'd be a good idea to put it on an ark. Well, I don't know, again, how that came about, but it was a bad idea. Yeah, really bad idea. But there was no excuse for not knowing how to carry the ark. Now, I'm not going to read the text. Those were probably pointed out this morning from Exodus chapter 25 and Numbers chapter 4. Verses 14 of Exodus 25, Exodus 25, 14 and 15, and Numbers 4, 15. Let's talk about how the Kohathites, they were, again, the Levites, they were Levites, they were of that family. The priestly tribe that's responsible for taking care of all these things, they were supposed to be responsible for carrying the ark, putting it on the pole, you know, taking the pole or putting it on their shoulders by carrying it by the poles, and the ark was supposed to be covered. So they knew. If they didn't, I don't know what they'd been doing. They certainly hadn't been reading the law and studying like they were supposed to, but the information was there. So it's not like God hadn't told them. And they disregarded it, and they carried the ark on, or David had the ark put on the cart. And we know that whenever it reached that threshing floor, don't know exactly where that was, the oxen stumbled, and, you know, obviously the ark wasn't strapped down because it was about to fall, or at least Uzzah perceived that it was about to fall, and he put up his hands. And it's easy to think, poor Uzzah. I mean, here he was, just this innocent bystander. I mean, he was just a guy that was going along with the cart, and, you know, it was about to fall, and, you know, it just, you know, just kind of a knee-jerk reaction. You would automatically put your hand up there to stop it. But that ark had been in his house for 70 years, and we have all the history behind it. So I think that Uzzah should have known better than to touch the ark. But he didn't. And certainly God held him accountable for his actions. You know, we don't have to speculate about what's going on in his mind, because what we're interested in is what God did. And God was angered by this whole process and this event. And so he struck Uzzah at this time, and he was angry with Uzzah, and he died. Because, and the text says in verse 7 of 2 Samuel chapter 6, and I'm reading from the New American Standard. The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down for his irreverence. Now, that's the New American Standard. The King James uses the word error. It is an irreverent act. That is, he had lack of reverence, lack of respect for God and God's will. That was manifested in his actions. And that's what the text tells us about why God was angry, because of his irreverence. And that's why I say that there is a lesson here about reverence that we need to learn. And there's an important and valuable consequence. Awareness of consequences that we need to be reminded of, and that is that there are consequences to irreverence, because again, he was smitten or struck dead. Now let's fast forward to the New Testament. Again, the idea is of respecting that which is holy. Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3 verse 1 beginning, know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, or some versions say grievous. And here's how he describes it. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy. Now, the lack of holiness, unholy, is one of the sins that's listed in this whole catalog of characteristics of people who, well, let's keep on reading, are unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, not loving what is good, traitors, headstrong, having been puffed up, that is this arrogant, you know, I can do it my way attitude, lovers of pleasure, Or does that sound like something that's contemporary with our world? Rather than lovers of God. Having a form of godliness, oh yeah, they're going through the motions. A lot of people are going through the motions. But denying its power. And Paul tells Timothy, you need to stay away from these people. Yeah, evil companionship corrupt good morals, don't they? But we're not prone to think much about unholiness. You know, we'll think about people who are unloving, or they're blasphemers, or they're brutal, or they're lovers of pleasure. You know, all of the obvious sins and the blatant sins that people commit. But unholiness is one of them. So it is just as important as lying, adultery, fornication, etc. Now, what's the antidote for all of this? Well, here's what Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 1. Charge certain men not to teach a different doctrine. Stick with what the Lord says. That's the bottom line. Stick with isn't that what Samuel told the Israelites to do? Obey him, keep his word, love him, and serve him. Neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questionings, rather than a dispensation of God which is in faith. So do I now. But the end of the charge is love out of a pure heart, and a good conscience, and faith unfeigned. That is genuine faith, not pretentious faith, not a fraudulent faith. Faith unfeigned. And then later on in that same chapter he said, but know, this is verse 8, but know that the law is good if a man use it lawfully, as knowing this, that law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and unruly, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy, there's the word again, and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers and manslayers and fornicators and abusers of themselves with men, that'd be homosexuals, for men stealers, for liars, for false swearers, if there be any other contrary to the sound doctrine, according to the gospel of the glory of the blessed God, which was committed to my trust. In one word, it's the gospel. The gospel is not just the good news about Jesus Christ. That is the gospel, true. But the gospel is everything that pertains to what God wants to do, to live in a way that's going to glorify him and show that we revere him and we respect him and honor him and esteem him to be high and holy. He is the Holy One. That's why he said, be ye holy, for I am holy. Uzzah failed to do that. The Israelites were given that command in the law. Again, it goes back to Leviticus 19:2. That's one of the places it's stated. It's also stated in, I don't remember. It's twice in the book of Leviticus, I believe. But this was the charge that God gave. Consider who I am. I'm holy, God is saying. And so that is to have a profound impact upon your life. Be holy. And be holy means we revere, we honor, we reverence, we respect, we stand in awe. All of those are synonyms of God and everything that is connected with God. So, there was a lot that Uzzah had been exposed to. All of the discontent and the irreverence and the ungodliness and the turmoil and the strife of Saul and David's escapades and his adventures and all of that. So, he was a person that had a lot of baggage, that's for sure. But we do too. Okay. We're exposed to much of the same thing. It's just a 21st century version of it, but it's not really anything that's new under the sun. And so we've got to defeat that. And of course we know that the antidote is the gospel. And we need to immerse ourselves in it. so that we can resist the devil. And if we do, James tells us, he will flee from us. If you're here tonight and you want some, you need encouragement, you need the prayers of the congregation, or if there's any spiritual matter that we can help you with, then this is the purpose of the invitation. We invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.